Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to episode 206 of Yes But Why podcast, featuring San Francisco-based performer, director, and educator, Radhika Rao. But first, a bit about our sponsor. This episode of Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. You can get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Guys, we're all at home. Audible has something to entertain you or enrich yourself with. Learn to garden, dig deeper into history, read Wuthering Heights and get it in a totally different way. No matter how you're spending your time in quarantine, Audible has something for you. Audible is available for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. This week's guest is Radhika Rao. Radhika is an actor, improviser, storyteller, director, writer, and arts educator out of San Francisco, California. Radhika was such a lovely person to talk to, and so well-adjusted. She tells stories about the ups and downs she's experienced, but she is so positive about it. She was really great, and honestly, revisiting this episode to edit it was another breath of fresh air. Things can be dicey these days, but guests like Radhika give me the strength to be excited again. I now present to you, Yes But Why, episode 206, Radhika Rao on trusting yourself and committing to your own path. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
I think I did one play in elementary school. And then I think I was part of one musical production in high school. And just to give you some context, I grew up in India. And I grew up at a time when schools were very, very academic and focused on academics. I think it's gone. Now there's much more art, I think, back in classrooms. So, but there was no focus on arts, really. And so those two experiences and just watching movies, I think gave me that feeling, that kind of confidence that I really like to perform. But I started performing in college. I joined the drama club. Oh. I went to a women's school and I joined the drama club there, and that's where I started performing. And then after I graduated, I decided to join a professional theater company. So I would say starting age 18 is when I started doing theater regularly.
Did you want to do it before that and you just didn't have the opportunity?
Yeah.
Or
yeah. I'm sure I wanted, I knew I wanted to act. I didn't think I had a sense of what theater was so much.
Yeah.
Because, you know, my parents didn't come from the arts world, so I wasn't really clued in, but I knew I wanted to act. But no opportunity, you know, nothing, you know, yeah.
So what was the drama club all about? Were they doing Shakespeare? Were you guys doing
It's India. So, you know, a lot of traditional
means.
India. Exactly. So to give you an example, yes, we did do Shakespeare's done all over the world. My first experience of Shakespeare was Julius Caesar in Hindi, which is amazing. Uh-huh. And I think I played like Portia. So the first time I ever did Shakespeare was in Hindi. The first time I ever saw Shakespeare was in like a dialect of Hindi, and it was a musical of Midsummer Night's Dream. But beyond that, like, we did a lot of like popular, you know, Indian plays, contemporary plays, some classical plays. And then we also did like a lot of famous playwrights, like, you know, are translated into Indian languages. So I did like Neil Simon and Eugene O'Neill and just like things like that, that you know, did in like the local language. And there's English theater as well, but English theater in India is done by rich people, and it's really like very privileged and weird kind of theater. But the Hindi theater is really authentic. So yeah, that's how
it's pretty
I started.
Great that there's access to like current playwrights that are working though, like even at a collegiate level. Like I don't think I read a play of a person that wasn't hundreds of years dead until long after I got out of college. I mean,
that's funny. Yeah, no, we had living, like there were living playwrights that we were studying, and then also we had India also has a very rich tradition of street theater. Which is where it's theater in the round, but you basically take over, occupy a space, a public space. And there's a few, like maybe percussion or a few instruments that people have, but everybody gets into circle, claps, gets into circle. And then in the round, you perform a play that speaks to the current like political milieu and you make a statement. So activism also happens in the form of theater, and you get a permit from the police or whatever, and then you just like occupy a space and talk about healthcare, or occupy a space and talk about women's rights. And it's through theater, and it can be improvisational in that the audience can talk back to you and you have to respond in the moment, and because it's like in the round and it's fluid, like the audience can, you know, come in and out, like it's very interesting, and you can go into the audience and there's no stage. So I guess some of my theater there was improvisational, even though I hadn't done improv. You know, I got into that later on in life.
Yeah. Was the political, occupying of a space something that happened like with your teachers? Like, were they like, this is a style that we're going to work on now, and then you like go and do that? Or was that just something that happened and like something that you noticed since you were now in a more theatrical state of mind?
Oh, that's, I don't think that I actually saw a street theater show, because they happen in certain parts of the city. I come from New Delhi, so that's the capital. But they happen closer to the political centers, you know, and where all the political activity happens. And I was more on the outskirts. I don't think I saw a play. When I started doing theater is when I really, you know, became part of this movement. But I didn't go to school for theater. I went to school for psychology. I just joined the drama club. So I've never formally studied theater.
Oh, sure. Right.
Yeah.
Was there even a theater major available?
There's one school that you go to, not a bachelor's theater major, but a master's that you can get after you do your bachelor's. And there was at that time, there was one school, and it was like a state school. And there was, it was one school for the entire country, really. And I didn't get in. I tried. I didn't get in. Oh. I wasn't good enough to be one of the billion Indians to get into a 30 seat, you know, to be one of the 30 lucky few, you know.
But crazy. One school is kind of intense. School. I mean, I know friends that are sad they didn't get into Yale grad school. And it's like, that's one of, you know, hundreds of theater grad schools they could have gone to. So it's like one school, like, that's you're crazy. Cool. I feel like you don't have to, don't feel bad.
crazy odds. It was fine. It was crazy odds. Plus there were quotas for different states, you know, like for different states, there's quotas. And I was from Delhi, which is like, it's like saying you're from New York or LA. Like there's a dime a dozen actor, like competitor.
So your chances were way worse than
way worse. And I don't think I was ready for it. You know, I don't even think I was that great. Like, you know, I wasn't that kid who was that theater kid. Like, nah.
Yeah, right on. So when you got out of college, were you like all into psychology? Did you like get a job in that? And like,
what happened
after college?
So I really wanted to do theater, and there was no programs. I tried to get into the school, and you know, I didn't get in. I was heartbroken, but I didn't want to get into psychology. And I really like human behavior, but I didn't think that I could listen to somebody for that long. And I didn't think psychology could make you happy. You know, I really felt like psychology couldn't make a difference. And that was my experience with psychology, you know. If positive psychology had been around at that time, I would have probably been more amenable to being a psychologist. But I just didn't want to sit around and listen. And But, you know, 20 years later, it's so funny because I do a lot of improv where it's all about listening. I'm a teacher. It's all about listening. I'm practicing Buddhist where like it's all about like taking in other people. But at that time, I didn't want to do it. So I joined a theater group. Yeah, I joined a theater group and I just said I'm going to, and they didn't even pay. But I stayed to my amazing Indian parents. Great dismay, one of whom is a doctor, the other one is an engineer. I was like, I'm going to join this theater group, but they were amazing enough that they were like, okay. But I just stayed at home and didn't make any money and was part of this theater group for a while. And eventually I got a job, teaching in an educational company using some of these theater skills in a school. But I mooched off my parents for a bit.
Oh, but right away you started teaching. Like that was part of your, you know, creative, journey was to immediately start teaching, huh? That's great.
I didn't wanna. My grandmother was a teacher, and I didn't think it was a great profession. But I think when you're an artist and you're broke, you get into teaching. And how it happened was a friend of mine was supposed to teach a puppetry workshop for an Outward Bound program, and she had to drop out because she was getting really big and getting gigs. And she said, "Would I like to teach?" And I said, "Yes," but I was so scared. And anyway, but that's how I got into it. And I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know if I know how to teach, but I think I like this. So it scared me and excited me and gave me a sense of purpose. So yeah, pretty much like within the first year of me, like really becoming a professional, like theater person, I started to teach and integrate theater in learning situations. And you know, that's the path I've been on.
That's pretty great. So tell me about your experiences up top. You're in the troupe, you're performing, yeah. You're living with your parents still.
Yeah.
How did you move forward from there? One assumes you're not still living with your parents.
No.
They decided to move to the Bay Area. You were like, yeah. All right, I guess.
No, it was way more, you know, crazy. Just to give you a cultural context, living with your parents isn't a big deal in India. So there was no shame to be.
Yeah. To be honest, I feel like everybody lives with their parents here too. So,
yeah, definitely the case in the Bay Area where real estate is so expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I was like 21, right? And I just, you know, new, fresh out of college. But I think I definitely did want to make my own money. So, you know, as I started, you know, I started finding these jobs that I can't remember how they came my way, but the one big life event that happened was when I was 22 and I was actually really unhappy in this theater group because there was just a lot of toxic relationships and artists can be complicated. And I kind of reached an existential crisis where I wasn't enjoying myself. And I just said, wow, I thought my life was about performing. And if I'm not enjoying what I thought was my dream, then, you know, what's the purpose of life? And I think I fell into this like really deep existential crisis. And I think I was probably borderline depressed, like undiagnosed depressed. But at that time, one of my friends she joined the same group that was causing me a lot of unhappiness. And she joined the same group, but somehow she was thriving and I was failing. And she had been trying to introduce me to Buddhism for many, many, you know, years. And, you know, sometimes to make a big shift in your life, you know, shit has to hit the fan. But, you know, I saw that it was actually her attitude and, you know, her life condition, a life state that was so elevated that people didn't mess with her the way they did with me. So long story short, like I started practicing Buddhism, which essentially asks you a question. It says, who do you want to be in the world? And it's not about the environment. It's about you, you know, and when you change, everything changes. So when I asked myself that question, it became very clear that I loved teaching. I loved performing and I was really passionate about creating a better world, you know, and world peace, if you will. I wasn't sure what that meant, but I just wanted people to get along. And I come from a very diverse country with various religions, castes, all kinds of stuff, and also a violent country because there's so much conflict. I mean, similar to America in so many ways. And so I kind of started like really chanting about that. And through many things that, you know, you could say coincidences, but I feel it was like the universe working. I got opportunities to teach, but also a friend of mine came back from Harvard, having done a program in theater and education. And he said, you've got to go there. And I was like, okay. And I, you know, I basically started looking into education programs because theater programs don't offer scholarships, and I didn't have any financial means. And not only did I start looking at theater education programs, I looked at doctoral programs because there was no funding at that time in India to send anybody for a master's program. So I started looking to doctoral programs, and I started writing applications on how to apply theater and education to create world peace. And I applied to a few schools, got rejected by all, but got accepted into Harvard. So that's how I came to America.
Wait, that's how you got to America, was Harvard?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I have a, you know, doctor. I'm a doctor of education.
That is crazy.
You
don't just have a doctorate in education. You have a doctorate in education from Harvard.
Yep.
Remember earlier when you were talking about how there was this school you really wanted to go to and it didn't work out for you? Well, yeah. Radhika, I am from Boston and I applied to Harvard and I did not get in. So that was my thing. That was the part of when I was 18 and I was like, yeah, I'm going to go to Harvard. And it was like, nope, thanks so much, other person from Boston. We don't care. And I was like, no. But...
I know it was so crazy.
What did you do? Like, what were, you know, you don't have to tell me everything, but like adventures. Wow.
It was amazing. I mean, it's very complicated. I don't know about undergrad because I went to grad school. But I'll say that anybody who goes to Harvard has a very complicated relationship with Harvard. It's not like, oh my God, I loved Harvard. Like in the Bay Area, anybody who went to like, you know, Berkeley, went to Cal State Berkeley, loves Berkeley, you know, UC Berkeley, excuse me, loves Berkeley. There's something about Berkeley, like you just are loyal. Everybody who went to Harvard is a little bit like, you know, it's always complicated. You can never really say you're from Harvard because every time you tell somebody, it's like dropping a bomb. You know, one of the first dating advices I got in America was that don't tell them you're from, don't drop the H-bomb, you know, because dudes get intimidated by that.
And
I know. But I went to the poorest school, you know, education, divinity, and the School of Public Health are the poorest schools. So we're like literally even on like, we're the smallest schools, we don't get a lot of scholarships. We don't have that much funding, but we're really happy people. The teacher, it's a school full of like people interested in teaching. So they're committing to a poor life, but it was really, really, you know, their school was probably one of the happiest places. The rest of Harvard can be full of like super intelligent, but really emotionally dysfunctional people. But I think the School of Education is probably one of the happiest schools, but it was kind of crazy, like to be at this place where, you know, there are these dudes like rowing and all of this like Widener Library, the biggest library, you know, in America. And you just continually, you just ask yourself what you're doing there. But to be very honest, it wasn't the most humanistic education. And when I was there, which is between 2003 and 2009, my program became less and less humanistic. So they shut down the Native American program. They shut down the gender studies program because I guess, you know, we're equal now and we don't really need to fight. You know, women don't really have anything to fight for. They systematically got rid of faculty that were working in race, class, and gender. So I came at a really interesting time, but I believe the purpose for me going there was to kind of know that, you know, Harvard or power or privilege or people who go to these elite institutions don't necessarily change the world. They might become president, but they may not change the world. You know, the country is full of like ex-Yale, Princeton, Harvard people, but they aren't, you know, they think with their heads, but not with their hearts enough, you know? So it was interesting. It was complicated. I got out in time and I wrote a good dissertation on how to use theater in building, you know, youth citizenship, which is like basically talking about high school theater programs and how it makes young people belong. And I studied particularly a program at Cambridge Dringe in Latin, which everybody knows is where Matt Damon and Ben Affleck went to school. Mm-hmm. but it was really amazing because it was a very, very diverse school. with a rich history. And there were many new immigrants there, many like kids of color, and who didn't feel like society just gave them the message that they didn't belong, that they, you know, you might have a passport, but you didn't belong. And so they did this program, this theater program, which is based off of like Theater of the Oppressed, and Anna Deavere Smith's Ethnodrama, which is basically where you go into your community and do interviews. And you record those interviews and then you perform those interviews. And so they went in as youth citizens, and the mayor of Cambridge, their program paid for these young people to be part of this program. So instead of working at like your local Sears or Kohl's or Macy's in the summer, they were part of this program. And they put this play together based on experiences of real people in Cambridge and talking about gentrification, social justice, violence in the community, you know, and they put the show up in front of the community, in front of Cambridge people. And then as youth leaders, they basically, you know, had dialogues with the community. So it was an incredible, that my dissertation was based off of that. And what happens when young people engage in a theatrical process that is geared towards like social justice and empowerment, how they start to feel like they belong in a community. And so, I mean, yeah, what does citizenship look like beyond voting? Because they were all under 18, these kids. But, you know, what does it look like if you can't vote, you know, which is, you know, a question that I continue to ask myself, because I have a green card and I'm not a citizen yet. I filed for citizen, but I technically can't vote. You know, and so, but what does it mean? Does that not mean I've lived in this country for 16 and a half years? In what ways do I participate in American democracy? So, yeah, that's what I ended up studying there.
That's really great. I really love this idea of like giving the voice to the youth, because, you know, they're at that point in their lives where it's really important for them to say what they are thinking and what matters to them.
Yeah.
Like, it's not always, you know, we don't always feel strong enough or fearless enough as we do when we're, you know, in high school. So it's important to empower them early. I think that is really, really amazing. And what a cool thing to do a dissertation on.
It was really great. Yeah. That was the last year of my program over there. Was really happy because I ended up, you can teach a class also as an, you know, as an later stage, you know, doctoral student. So I ended up teaching a class about, you know, this topic. And I also ended up like doing a great dissertation, and I played a leading, I was so tired because I, for 5 years, I hadn't done theater, but I was studying theater, but I hadn't been in a play. So I think out of my frustration, I auditioned and was cast as the lead in a show, just a small like company in Boston, but I ended up like doing that too. And so I felt very victorious by the end of it.
Yeah. You did it all.
Yeah.
That's great.
I did it all.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Nice.
And then I got out of there and I'm like, I'm not going into academia. I can't deal with this. I can't deal with this. Like, I need to go back into the classrooms. I need to teach. I need to act. I need to go back to my roots, you know. And, you know, and I had in my second semester fallen in love with, you know, a person who was also at Harvard. And he, by that time, had moved to San Diego to become a professor of literature. And so I kind of followed him to San Diego, and then he got a job, you know, in San Francisco. And that's how we moved, you know, that's how we moved out here. So I let patriarchy move me to California, but I'm not complaining. And then our marriage fell apart, which is really fun too.
Oh, fun. Okay.
But
great.
At least you have a good point of view. Yeah. But at least I ended up in San Francisco.
Yeah. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Yeah, well, you know, I like that you say the patriarchy moved you out. You know, just because you moved to be in a relationship doesn't necessarily mean it was patriarchy. I mean, it sounds to me like you needed to change it up. And as a person who is originally from Boston, I know that the tone of that city can be a little intense. And
yes,
probably needed to move anywhere. So, when he was like, hey, do you want to be in gorgeous San Diego? You were like, yeah, I'm going. And if I don't have to hear another guy yell in an accent that's deeply disturbing, I got to get out of here.
You know what the funny thing was? I really love Boston because I come from a city that's like 10 times less friendly than Boston. So when I came to Boston, I was like, whoa, this is great. And it was, I actually didn't want to move, you know, and I say patriarchy because so often women move because men are paid more money and men have the more lucrative jobs. And so we give up our lives, but I really didn't want to move. But at the same time, you're right. I needed the sunshine, but I hated San Diego for the first 6 months because I was like, wow, I'm going from a liberal to kind of this conservative place. I was like, why is it sunny all the time? Why are people smiling all the time?
This maybe sucks. Boston is right for you. I don't know.
No, not anymore. Not anymore. I am so a Californian. But the funniest thing was, you know, I have an Indian accent, but when I came to California, people are like, wow, you sound like you're from Boston. So I had a Boston.
You were infected.
I think I had a Boston Indian accent.
They're like, oh, where in Boston smacked. Are you She's from? Smacked. And you're like, oh God, get me out of here. I've never heard, you're so funny. I've never heard anybody in the world say that Boston seemed friendly. What's funny is my token story is right after college, I moved to New York City. So when I moved to New York City, I was like, wow, everyone here is so nice and friendly. And people were like, what are you talking about? And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. I forgot to mention I'm from Boston. So New York is like, oh, look at how gentle and sweet they are to each other. Like, now I live in Austin, which, let's be clear, is a magical wonderland.
I've heard.
It is, yeah. I mean, certainly compared to Boston and New York.
Yeah.
As I'm sure San Francisco is compared to, you know, New Delhi and then Boston.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh man. So when you finally got to the Bay Area, were you able to, now this whole time that you've been going to Harvard, have you been still practicing and getting inspiration and strength from your Buddhism? It was like, so that was such a big deal that like sort of got you on the path. I wonder, you know, did it maintain for you while you were there?
Absolutely. It was a source of great support. And, you know, I was quite unhappy through much of my time at Harvard because I, you know, a lot of things that happened over there that just weren't amenable. Like what I wanted to study, like, you know, all the professors were leaving in that field. So didn't know if I belonged. I felt very, very sick. We sometimes call it a Harvard sickness, you know, that people are just so, there's just that kind of like drive and unbalanced lifestyle that makes people sick. So, you know, I felt sick for about 6 months and I had to take a break from my program. But through all of that, Buddhism gave me so much strength and just, just like gave me that kind of confidence that I just needed to finish the program and make the best of it. And even in moments of strife, like so much value can be created. It's never, you know, actually when you face adversity, that's when you grow the most in your life. So, so that absolutely, there was a community there and the Buddhist organization that I belong to called the Soka Gakkai International, they exist everywhere, even in Austin. And so, you know, I was just able to just like join there and, it was there and it still is a big part of my life and how I, you know, approach the world and how I deal with any difficult moments or how I appreciate the good moments. Yeah.
Yeah. But since you've gotten to the Bay Area, have things gotten, I mean, I guess after the tumultuous end of the relationship, were you able to find like a new community, you know, or, you know, like how did it go for you? You moved to San Fran, relationship, not awesome. And then you got to figure it out. What happened then?
That was, it's so interesting. I think my marriage ended 2015. So it's been 5 years now. It's incredible. And that was also like a really crazy time in America. That was like, we still had a clinically sane president, you know, in the White House. But like now it's like, sorry, I don't know what your politics are, but so I'm just talking from. But it was also like, you know, I think it was a crazy time in America, but I think when that fell apart, I was actually really thriving in my professional career. And I almost feel it was because I was really booming and I was starting to grow and my work was getting a lot of attention in a way that it hadn't gotten before in San Diego or in Boston, that I think sometimes relationships fall apart, you know, because of that. Or my ex might have thought, like, you know, maybe this is not the life I want with a performing artist. I don't know what his thinking was, and you know, but sure. I basically got dumped, and it was really interesting that I said yes to that. Like, talk about, like, you know, just saying yes to yes. And I think that yes was coming from a really deep conviction. There's something when sometimes your life just gives you these messages and you know, if you tune in and follow them, it's really great. So I think when a relationship falls apart, sometimes like the just two people are just with each other, but there were these people in my periphery. I've always valued friends and I've always prided myself on being a good friend. But I think when that marriage fell apart, those people that were in the periphery came into the focus, and it's almost like my family grew from a family of two to like a family of like 100, you know? And so I was actually, because I was a performing artist, and this is 2015, so the economy is shit. Like, the real estate is up, like real estate is like bad in San Francisco. Rent is crazy. There's not that many great paying jobs for artists or teachers. Jobs are being cut. Like, it was so bad. But I ended up, what ended up happening is I did move out, but shortly after I couldn't pay rent anymore. And I ended up living with friends for a year and a half. I moved 9 times in a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And I had, you know, that's when I discovered how many great friends I have, you know, because I actually lived very comfortably and always had a room of my own, you know, and crashed with friends, you know. So it pays to be Indian, because there's a lot of software engineer friends I had, you know, who were in the Bay Area. And that's why I'm like, kids, don't do a BFA program. Then you'll only know poor people. So
it's okay. I mean, we're all going to pay student loans. Just get a business degree. It'll be better.
Just better.
It'll help you run your theater.
Yeah. So I, you know, that was a great experience where like community really grew for me. Yeah. And a big part of my community, there was a Buddhist community, and then there was a theater performing community, and the improv community, and the teaching community. And, you know, and then friends who I'd known from school that happened to be in the area or from college. And, you know, they just came suddenly, and to sharp relief, you know, they were just there, you know. So it was really amazing. And so for a year and a half, I didn't pay rent in the Bay Area. And so I was able to take these artistic risks with my life and really grow my artistic and professional like resume and career without like worrying too much about rent, which is sometimes half of our income in the Bay Area. But if not half, like 30 to 40%. And because of that, like, I think I really solidified. Because when my marriage fell apart, I wasn't making that much money. My ex was. So I wondered if I needed to take on a regular job. But I just never did. I just kept continuing with my passion and doing this, you know, this kind of like, I don't even know what to call it, like potpourri of stuff that I do, you know, and I just gained great conviction. And now I'm like, dang, if I can be single and live in San Francisco and, you know, and survive, I live in a rent controlled apartment, I'm able to manifest that, then you know what? I just need to keep following my dreams and keep going on my path. Like, I don't need to backtrack.
You have a great perspective on what's happened through the journey. Yeah. That's really great.
I do thank my ex every day, because it was painful. But, you know, like, these are Buddhism. This is also a Buddhist perspective, that even people who cause you pain, if you really, you know, can be your good friends, because he really wasn't the partner who was going to support the life that I wanted, you know. And I would have. There's a part of you that you kind of, that I was hiding being with him, that I didn't realize. And so it just let me just blossom. So, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do thank him. I do thank him,
man,
for that. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm so much happier that I have no, like, I don't have any pain or any regrets from that. You know, I get dumped a lot, because I think sometimes I don't know my own worth. So I get dumped a lot. So now I have like a lot of confidence in the universe. I'm like, oh, okay. I didn't think it was good enough.
You're like, it's fine. Turns out that guy wasn't it. See ya.
It wasn't it. It wasn't it. And yeah. it always happens that it's right. You know, and obviously I'm constantly working on myself, but I think that I, you know, it's also not about working on yourself. It's about just being who you are and, you know, finding that person who's able to, you know, be with you the way you are. I think I'm pretty awesome. So,
yeah, but yeah, totally.
That's kind of it. Yeah.
I also like to think about how, like, you mentioned it earlier, the idea that, like, you know, you have to want to have a certain kind of lifestyle with a person. You have to be cool with them having the kind of job that they do. You know, it's like, I'm sorry that I don't have the kind of security that brings in money every week or every other week. Like, it's a smattering here and there, but I'm doing what I want to do. Can you handle being part of that? Like, and some people can't, like... That's a really interesting part that I've noticed as, you know, friends of mine have coupled or not, you know, and it's like, well, you know, that person's an artist through and through. They're like never going to stop doing that. So you can't just expect them to, I don't know, get a 9-to-5. That's just not the world that they could do.
No. And it's, exactly. And I think it's part of this is growing up, right? Like I met my, you know, then partner when I was, you know, I just turned 27 and our relationship fell apart when I was 38, you know? Mm. And so you're a different person then, and you don't even have I didn't even have the language. I think when you're mid 20s, sometimes you're just looking for the one, and, you know, it's just a very different dynamic. But it's interesting being in this second phase of my life where I have language and I know what I want and I know what I deserve. And it's like, you're just there with eyes that are way more open than when I was younger. Like I just didn't have that kind of perspective. So it's a lot of growing up.
It's a lot better having the perspective to look back at various adventures that I've had and, you know how I felt about them at the time and then see recently I've had a few moments where like I'll think about something that I did in my past and old lady Amy is like, oh my goodness, I can't believe I did such a thing. But at the time I remember, you know, being like, this is crazy, but you're going to do this and it's going to be okay. And then I'm like, oh my God, oh my stars, older me says, right? But that's why younger people do wilder things. It's amazing the distance we can have from the mistakes that we made such that we can learn from them and actually become really, truly better people.
Yeah.
In that scenario, you know?
Yeah.
So right now in your life, and I know that this won't be released like tomorrow or whatever, but like, what's the exciting thing that you're working on right now? Like, what's the project that you're most excited about at this very moment?
Yeah. So many. And that's just generally like, you know, that's just generally the pattern of my life that I'm excited. Like last year I wasn't, but I'm so happy to say I'm excited. I'm inspired. So I've been acting for 20 years of my life now, but this year I'm directing two really wonderful pieces. And, you know, one of them is for a festival that's called Les Rights, you know, as in lesbian rights. And it's at this theater called Three Girls Theater, but I'm directing a women's, you know, a two person show, between, which is, you know, a play about a non-binary Gen Zer, you know, college student. And the other is about, and the other person in the play is her grandma, who's a lesbian grandma. And it's all about like language changing and gender binaries and who fought for what. And, you know, and so it's really cool. I'm working on directing that. I'm directing a one woman show, with a friend of mine in it. I'm, a play of mine that has traveled, to many cities, including Houston, is going to, is being, revived, and it's showing at this theater called Z Space, which is a dance drama about, an empress, a South Asian, empress, a Persian empress who migrates to, you know, to India and becomes the most, you know, famous first lady ever. And so it's a big feminist piece from a South Asian perspective. It's a dance drama. And I do like 15 voices for the dancer who's the front of the stage. Super excited about that. I just, finished shooting an episode for a series called Hirayat, which is about immigrants in America. And the first episode is on Amazon Prime. It's spelled H-I-R-A-E-T-H. And I think I'm in the second episode, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure. But I just finished shooting that. Yeah. And then, so there's a lot of that. Yeah, I'm busy and yeah. I'm teaching a lot. I'm teaching improv a lot. I'm teaching seniors for the first time, like senior citizens. I'm going to be teaching them long form improv, which I'm really excited about. And they apparently make amazing improvisers, of course, because they have all this life experience and they don't give a damn.
And, yeah, I've had a couple of students in their 80s and they were real fun.
Wow. Yeah. So I'm very, very excited about that. And I teach a course at the University of San Francisco that I'm very excited about. That's teaches how to use arts in the classroom. And so, and then I'm doing a few corporate gigs, you know, like in San Francisco, you know, we have a lot of techies who want to know how to communicate, eye contact.
Nice.
So we play games with them, learn, you know, speak to them about their voice and improv and improvisational activities really helps them open up. So that kind of work. I also work in like medical schools. You know, do you know what a standardized patient program is?
No, tell me about it.
So it's a now pretty widely used, but it is a it's a training and every like well-funded medical school, medical students will see a standardized patient, which is a fake patient, so that they see and so that they get the experience of meeting a real person, you know, in a simulated situation. And
so you act as the patient?
So we act as the patient, then we play out the scenario, and then we partner with the medical faculty to talk to them about their social skills, you know, and their whether they were empathic enough, whether they were, was there anything in their voice that was judgy? Did they use your name during the encounter? Did they smile? Did they, you know, what were their bedside manner like? So it's really cool. Yeah. It's kind of an acting and an educational position, and I do a lot of that. So I'm always very excited to do that kind of medical acting, so to speak. You know, we're currently piloting remote cases of, you know, a lot of doctors now in healthcare systems allow patients to Skype their doctors, but that's a totally different, you know, can of worms. So we're teaching doctors how to socially relate, you know, to their patients over Skype or over like, you know, Zoom or something like that, and the barriers that need to be crossed for that. So it's really fun.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's some really important stuff that doctors need to have as skills, you know.
Yeah.
They've got some delicate information to be parsing out.
Very delicate.
To be, you got to be careful with that kind of thing.
Yeah, the last case I did was about, they basically have to tell me that the baby in my womb, you have these fake wombs, it's very high tech, but they have to tell me that I have a stillborn child in my, like, because I think my water is broke. My water broke and I think I'm going to have a baby, but they have to tell me that it's not a viable pregnancy and that my baby is dead. And I have to break down and cry, and it's crazy. And so they're learning those kind of like, how do you, even those kind of situations, like how do you deliver like that kind of news? So it's very draining and very exciting. And because we have actor skills, you know, we can break out of it, but those poor nurses and doctors are often like totally shook by the situation.
Oh yeah. That's true. I forget that. You know, I was recently talking to like an actor friend about like sort of the breadth of emotion that I like feel in a day. And we were discussing like, you know, that not everybody feels that way. Right. And I'm like, I think that's crazy. Like I'm like breaking down in like crying, like hard tears at a like radio commercial. And like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm like, he just got the mortgage, you know, like, I can't get around it. It's just like, and you know, when I teach my acting classes, I'll say things to them like, you know, your creative ability allows you to access a part of the world that other people can't access. So that's where you get it, that you're able to act like other people and understand them and have a deeper empathy, is because you just have a natural ability to access that emotion. Some people are like, yeah, I'm happy, what? But I'm like, no, I've got like gradients of happy where I'm like, you know, I don't know. I'm a little, but not a lot. I was like 20%, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right. Now we're like emotional bungee jumpers. Like we just jump off, you know, and it's like, and it's, it, there's a lot of courage required, but it's like, you know, we're not putting out fires or we're not like going to war, but emotionally we have a lot of courage.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you've spoken a lot about, you know, a lot of courage, actually, a lot of different wild things have happened in your life, and you've like made it through and maintained your sort of creative path throughout, even though, you know, I appreciate that your point of view is positive. So like you, everything that happened that was hard, you're like, but it sprung me towards the next great thing, but not everybody looks at it that way.
No.
What advice do you have for people to like keep it going, you know, like when times are tough, you've clearly kept it going. Like you could have quit, you could have been like, okay, I'll work, you know, in a travel agency or whatever, but you didn't. You were like, I'm gonna do this. How did you keep it going? What kept your strength up?
I mean, I think what kept my strength up, you know, really was, you know, my faith, you know, in myself. But when I say faith in myself, it really came from my, you know, Buddhist practice, which enabled me to trust myself and also the community that I was, you know, surrounded by. And, you know, I sometimes, even when I feel alone, I think I'd realize there's always people around you, you know, there's always people who want to help and are there. So I wouldn't have been able to do it without like my friends and my family and, you know, how, you know, incredible they are. And I realized how much, you know, privilege I had in that situation. But advice that I would give, especially to people who are in the arts or in difficult professions, like maybe nursing or teaching or, you know, is to really commit to your mental, emotional, and spiritual health. I think we don't prioritize that enough. And, you know, we're at a very crucial time in America's like history. We have like a suicide epidemic in this country, you know, especially with young people. You know, we have a loneliness epidemic. We haven't prioritized relationships and we haven't prioritized emotional health. And I believe we're collectively sick as a society. It's not just, you know, it's not healthy for there to be shootings every day someplace in America. It's not healthy for us, for, you know, young people or people to take their lives. But it's collectively, there's something off. And so we really need to commit to our mental, emotional, and psychological health. And I feel like because I did that, you know, I did that when I was young, by the time like life got tougher, you know, in my late 30s, like I had tools. So we need tools, because especially as an artist or whatever your path is, if you want to be successful, like you said, it's not going to be, you know, very few people make it big or are discovered in a moment. Most of the times it's a journey. And even sometimes when you hit the big time, that doesn't guarantee happiness at all. You know, we're truly happy when we do what we're meant to do on this planet, and only we can do what we can do. And that's a really important lesson. And whatever you do that brings other people happiness and creates value will ultimately come back to you. So, you know, that kind of messaging is very hard to give to yourself if you don't have a community or kind of a value system. So whatever it is, like, commit to your emotional and spiritual health. You know, it doesn't need to be religion, but there is something called the spirit, you know? So yeah, that's what I would say is, would be my advice.
It's and funny find because people who I believe found in that you. In improv, you know, like I found the tools that I needed to get through some of the harder times, you know?
Yes.
You know, sometimes the, like, just, you know how, like, the beauty of letting it go, like at the end of a scene when it's over and like you never go back to it again, like that, embracing that, like in real life, every moment, you know what I mean? Like, I try to have, especially, okay, also, once you have a baby and you're, like, on your own walking around with the baby, you yeah. are just, like, a lonely island trying to find other people to talk to. Like, oh, hey. So I go to the grocery store and have random conversations with strangers because I hadn't talked to an adult in multiple days. Like,
right.
And the improv helped me through it. So I was like, I can do this. Just talk about anything. And I'm like, apples, am I right? Right. Like, yeah. It's like, so it's a great way to help you open up and connect and, you know, to give you the tools to be with other people and it feel less scary than it could.
I 100% agree. Improv has given me that, you know, being there with the other person, listening, making your partner look good, you know, yeah. all of those tools. I've really learned to just to say yes to that moment. And I love what you just said about, like, you know, it's never going to come back again. So just let it go, you know? And yeah, it's also taught me about breathing a lot, you know, just breathing and mindfulness, mm-hmm. you know, and just breathe. You don't have to, you know, just take a moment. You don't have to immediately respond or react or, you know, try to be funny. The funny is always in the unexpected, you know, and life is funny because whenever you tell your story, when the trauma is passed, everything that happens to you is kind of funny.
Oh, yeah. That's my favorite. When something terrible happens, there is a voice in the back of my head that just goes, in enough time, this will be a great story. This will be a great story someday. Not right now, but someday not right now. You're going to be like, let me tell you about that time this thing happened.
Yep.
I have a bunch of those, too, where I'm like, you think a terrible thing is going to change your whole life? Let me tell you how this terrible thing happened to me. And look, I'm not gone.
Man.
Well, Radhika, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk to me, to share your stories with me. I really appreciate you telling me about your journey. And, you know, you just have a great attitude and a good energy that, you know, hopefully will inspire some people in my audience to get out there and be an actor or just commit to their creative path the way that you have.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.